As we get underway today, I have been organizing the questions you submitted to me on the first day of the conference, and I want to go through a few by way of review. Make sure you're all with me, that you're all awake. In fact, to make sure that you're all awake, we're going to practice our nodding in unison. I hope that you spent some time. Many of you were up late last night. I felt badly. I was sure you must have been up practicing nodding in unison to make me happier, okay? So now when a good point is made, and I say, this is really pathetic. It needs work. In unison, and everybody's got to be part. If I don't see you participating, then we're going to have you come up and work it out in front of the rest of the audience. Okay, so when a good point is made in a debate and we say, that's better. Okay. Somebody wrote, speaking of mere opinion, the non-Christian can say that the existence of God is just an opinion of mine. How can I prove that God does exist? And the short answer to this is, without God, you can't prove anything. Somebody says, how can you prove God exists? The answer is, God is the precondition of all proof. Because what is taken for granted when you assume the methodology of science, or you use logic, or appeal to moral absolutes, is something about the world that only makes sense if God exists. And so the proof of God's existence, you already know this, it's just review, the proof of God's existence is that without Him you can't prove anything. Then another card said, give an argument to support the truth that we are not products of a blind physical, that Darwinism is a lie and that creation by God is the truth. You may remember that we covered this in our last lecture time together. There are tremendous absurdities in the story of man's origin as it's told by the Darwinians. In fact, there are so many absurdities that when evolutionists get around to speaking of the mechanism of evolution, all they can do is give us a philosophical rather than a scientific understanding or a philosophical account of how man came about. Remember how the survival of the fittest proved to be nothing more upon analysis but a claim that the survivors are the ones that survive. And that the theory of evolution makes us believe that life came from non-life, intelligence from non-intelligence, morality from non-morality, and so forth. Moreover, if the argument is that we are products of blind physical science, I want you to note this, it's the blindness of chance that undermines physical science. So when people say, I think the physical universe operates in a blind fashion or a random or a chance fashion, and that it's that physical universe that accounts for my origin, the person has, without putting it right up there where you can see it, contradicted himself. Because if it's blind, it can't account for anything. It's meaningless. And so that would undermine the scientific endeavor as well. And then a further card asked, seeing that God is all-powerful and all-knowing, why does evil exist? And that's the subject of this particular lecture. Perhaps the most intense, pained, and persistent challenge that believers hear about the truth of the Christian message comes in the form of what we call the problem of evil. The suffering and evil which we see all about us seems to cry out against the existence of God, at least a God that's benevolent and a God that is almighty. This is thought by many to be the most difficult of all the problems which we face as Christians, not only because of the apparent logical difficulty within the Christian outlook, but also because of the great personal perplexity which any sensitive human being feels when confronted with the terrible misery and the wickedness that's found all around us in the world. Man's inhumanity to man is notorious, notorious in every age of history. And in every nation of the world, there's a long story of oppression, indignity, unkindness, torture, and tyranny. We find war and murder, greed and lust, dishonesty, lies,
fear, hatred, infidelity, cruelty, poverty, racial hostility. And then when we look at the natural world, we see what appears to be needless suffering and pain, birth defects and parasites, attacks of violent animals, radioactive mutations, debilitating diseases, deadly cancer, starvation, crippling injuries, typhoons, earthquakes, and on the list of natural disasters goes. And so when the unbeliever looks at this really unhappy veil of tears, he feels there's strong reason to doubt the goodness of God. Why should there be so much misery? Why should it be distributed in such a seemingly unjust fashion? After all, as Dostoevsky asked in Brothers Karamazov, if it were left to you to be the architect of the world, would you permit this kind of misery? And most people would say to that rhetorical question, of course not. Now, I think it's very important that when you come up against that kind of objection, that you remember that often people who are bringing it up are doing so because they personally have been affected by the wickedness and the cruelty and the pain in this world. It's always important to take account of the emotional or existential condition of the person that you're talking to. I don't want to say it's only here, but it's especially here I've noticed that people will bring up things. They want to know why their brother died in childhood. They want to know why they had to lose their mother to cancer so early in life, and things like that. So remember your audience. Don't imagine that when you're answering this, it's just a matter of slicing and dicing the academic side or the philosophical side of this. You need to minister to that person. And hopefully by the end of this lecture, you'll have some idea of how that can be done. Recently in Moscow, I gave a lecture at the Russian Orthodox University on Dostoevsky's Problem of Evil, where I used one portion of Dostoevsky's writings to show the presentation of the problem, but also how the author himself in his own life resolved it. And in talking about that, when I finished the lecture, I asked the students if they had questions, and I was kind of expecting, because here's this foreigner in an academic setting and so forth and so on, kind of expecting that the philosophical angle on this was going to, you know, be what people want to take on. But there was a young Russian girl who began the questioning with tears in her eyes. And she said, "Dr. Bonson, I understand how the problem of evil can be answered by those of us who are believers when people who are atheists throw that at us." She said, "What I don't understand is how we who are believers can answer the problem of evil, because it seems so often the righteous suffer." And she had been through a lot. Not just her. Those who claim the name of Christ in Moscow have suffered for years. And she wanted to know how these sorts of things can take place if God is really in control of the universe. So I need to remember, too, when I go out and lecture, I'm talking to people who don't just think, you know, they live in this world. And God was very gracious and I think gave me some grace to respond to her. I talked to her about the evil I've suffered in this world. I talked to her about the sorts of physical problems that I have with disease and so forth, and some of the injustices and hard things that I've been through. And I could tell that for all of the hoped brilliance of the philosophy, it's when I told her that I suffer and hurt as well that I realized that she was listening. And I told her that in the end, as a believer, when I want to cry out to God, why do you let these things happen? And even committed Christians struggle with God. You read the Psalms, you'll see David struggled with God, wondered about these things. It's very helpful for me to remember that the first word of Jesus in the famous line from the cross is also why. Why have you forsaken me? And if the Lord of glory, who knows everything, could also suffer that, then I don't believe that I've lost my humanity or my conviction about God just because it hurts me too. So please remember, when the problem of evil is brought up, it's not always being brought up by a snide philosopher, professor, who thinks he's just going to whittle the Christian faith down by that. Many times people are suffering personally Secondly, it's important for you to recognize and indeed to insist upon the reality and the serious nature of evil. The subject of evil is not an intellectual parlor game. It's not something to be dealt with in a cavalier manner, something whimsical, some relativistic choice, or simply one personal way of looking at things in the world. Evil is real and evil is ugly. A couple of days ago, you heard one of the speakers refer to this Jewish intellectual, Dennis Prager. Out in Southern California, Dennis Prager used to have, I'm told, the most popular religious radio program in Southern California on Sunday evenings. And his format was to have a Jew and a Roman Catholic priest and a Protestant minister, Jewish rabbi, all appear, and he would throw some religious question out, and they would kind of kick it around for about a half hour. Then for an hour and a half, there'd be call-in from people outside. And a couple of evenings, I was the Protestant representative on the show. One night, I had occasion to speak of, I don't remember how it came out, but I remember using this expression about adoring God. And somebody called in and was irate with me for talking about adoring God, and I asked why. And he said, if I understand right, he had been on some jury during that last week in a particularly terrible case of child molestation, had to look at pictures of this child that had been abused and so forth. And he said, how can you speak of adoring a God that would allow that kind of thing to happen? Well, I could see the other people in the room backing away from their microphones like, that one's all yours, Dr. Bunsen. Okay. But you see, I wanted him to be indignant. I appreciated his indignation. I didn't want him to be cavalier about that. I said, that really makes you angry, doesn't it? He said, it really does. I said, it does me too. And I want you'll see by the end of the lecture why it's important that when people bring up the problem of evil, they bring it up as evil, not just as unhappiness, not just as different strokes for different folks, but as something that they want to condemn. Let's see why you have to take it seriously, or why in terms of defending the faith, it's important you take it seriously. The problem of evil is, first of all, a logical problem. Let me try to explain. You'll be told that Christians hold to a series of premises and that you cannot hold all of those premises consistently. And I'm going to simplify this. We believe that God is all good. Secondly, we believe that God is all-powerful. Thirdly, we believe that evil exists. But, as the argument goes, if God is all good, he wouldn't want that evil. Secondly, if he's all-powerful, he could eliminate that evil. Therefore, if evil exists, God is either not all good or not all-powerful. And that's the logical problem of evil. Allegedly, there's an incoherence in the Christian worldview because we have premises which will not logically hang together. But I'm going to ask this question. If you remember, I put up on the board again the four things you keep looking at when somebody gives an argument against Christianity. You want to know if that argument will fly. Ask, is this an arbitrary consideration? Are there inconsistencies in this presentation? What are the consequences of it? What are the preconditions of it? For whom is evil logically a problem? Is evil logically a problem for the Christian, or is evil logically a problem for the non-Christian? It should be obvious upon reflection that the unbeliever cannot urge the problem of evil against you or against me unless the unbeliever has the right to assert there is evil. If there's nothing that counts as evil, then there's no problem of evil that has to be accounted for. And so it's crucial to the unbeliever's case against Christianity to be able to assert that there's evil in the world, to evaluate some specific instance as an instance of evil. So what does the unbeliever mean by good and evil? By what standard does the unbeliever determine what counts as good or what counts as evil? What are the presuppositions in terms of which the unbeliever makes any moral judgment about goodness or evil whatsoever? Let's look at some possibilities, go through them real quickly. We could do a full course in metaethics, but I'm going to reduce this down to about 5 or 6 minutes consideration. Perhaps the unbeliever takes the word good and evil to pertain to what evokes public approval or disapproval. But if evil or good pertains to the evoking of approval or disapproval, then on that basis, the following statement would always be senseless. We sometimes say the vast majority of the community heartily approved of and willingly joined in that evil deed. But you see, if evil is what evokes the community's disapproval, then it could never be true that the majority of people engaged in an evil deed. The unbeliever, you see, is using a concept of evil that actually precludes a very common line of discussion or comment in the English language. The fact that a large number of people feel a certain way shouldn't rationally convince anybody that that feeling is correct. Ethics doesn't reduce to statistics. Ordinarily, people think of the goodness of something as evoking their approval rather than their approval constituting its goodness. See, even unbelievers talk and act as though there are personal traits, actions, or things which possess the property of goodness or the property of evil, irrespective of the attitudes or beliefs or feelings that people have about those traits, actions, or things. Now, if there's problems in saying that good and evil are defined by what evokes the approval of most people or the disapproval of most people, then the problem is even worse if you think that good is defined by what evokes the approval of the individual rather than the public at large. If by the use of the word good somebody means I approve, then it turns out that we could never, ever agree with each other in ethical judgments. Now, I realize this philosophy quickly, but I want you to see how easy it is to refute these points of view. Boom, 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 boom. If good means Greg approves of it. So when I say, you know, helping that old lady, that was good. And somebody says, okay, good means evokes the approval of the speaker. Then it turns out you and I can never agree on an ethical judgment. You know why? Because when I say helping the old lady is good, what I mean is I approve of it. When I say that you think helping the old lady is good, that means that you approve of it. But that you approve of it and that I approve of it is not the same judgment. One is a judgment about me, one's a judgment about you. And therefore, there is no public or objective nature to good. The unbeliever usually turns then to what's called instrumental theories of good, saying that good is defined by the consequences that are brought about by an attitude or an action. An action is good if it achieves a certain end, like the greatest happiness for the greatest number, what we call utilitarianism. Now, the irrelevance of that concept of goodness for making ethical determinations is that one would need to be able to rate and compare happiness in order to make any judgment about goodness. If I say the good act is what promotes the greatest happiness for the greatest number, then I need to be able to evaluate or in some way measure the happiness that is created by the action. Moreover, I need to be able to compare, because some actions might bring unhappiness to a few individuals, or maybe to many, and the same action would bring happiness to a lot of individuals or a few. So you have unhappiness and happiness that have to be balanced, and then you have to draw a net judgment. Okay, so I'm going to give you an illustration. Let's say we take one of the students at the conference, maybe one of the students that's, you know, particularly disliked, hasn't been showering, using deodorant this week. And I bring this person up here and I say, now I've got this pin and I propose to stick this pin in this individual. Now, how many of you are going to be made happy by my doing that? Let him have it! And I say, now how many of you think it's going to hurt him? That's why we want you to let him have it. But you see, I've got to measure his unhappiness if I'm going to be a utilitarian. Okay, and so what if the person now appeals with me, please, Dr. Bonson, don't stick the pin in me. I say, give me an argument, you utilitarian, you. He says, well, it so happens that the amassed unhappiness that I will undergo outweighs the total happiness of this group. I say, well, I don't think that's true. But he's going to say, well, then how do you prove otherwise? You see, utilitarianism, which appeals to so many people, in fact, liberal theology thinks utilitarianism, which was destroyed philosophically long before Joseph Fletcher got hold of it and thought that was the way to define love, utilitarianism makes it impossible to make moral judgments. All we can do is guess at what would bring the greatest happiness for the greatest number. We can't really prove it one way or another because we can't calculate all the consequences and we can't compare pains and pleasures. Utilitarianism is really unworkable, but there's even a more fundamental logical problem with utilitarianism. Utilitarianism, or any consequential instrumental view of goodness, says good is what produces a particular end. But you see, you could only know that that was good if the end that is mentioned is what? Good. That is to say, consequential theories of ethics always beg the question as to what is intrinsically good. Because they say, well, the good is whatever achieves this goal. Libertarians will say, it's good if it maximizes freedom for people. Well, they're right if freedom for people is itself good. But that's what has to be defended. Unbelievers don't do that. So I've tried to run through quickly some views of goodness that have been propagated in the 20th century, evokes approval, public, individual, or is instrumental, and it turns out none of them are workable theories of meta-ethics, that is, the philosophy of ethics. What is the nature of good and evil? Why am I bothering to bore you with these illustrations? Because if the unbeliever says you have an inconsistency in your system, you say God is all good, you say God is all powerful, and then there's this evil, you have the right to say, can you prove that that's evil? And it turns out they can't prove that what they're talking about is evil. Be careful right here. This is, I've noticed, taught Christians to do apologetics for a number of years. Trust me, many people get bamboozled at just this point. Because if I'm dealing with an unbeliever, let's talk about the guy who called in on that radio program. He's talking about a terrible case of child molestation. And I say, you need to show on your premises why that is evil. He comes back and he says to me, oh, you don't think that's evil? And the temptation is for you to think, oh yeah, I don't want to say that that's not evil. That is evil. The point is, you can say that it's evil because your worldview accounts for that judgment. Because there is a living and true creator of heaven and earth who sovereignly controls all things and whose character is holy and unchanging, has revealed himself and so forth and so on, it makes perfectly good sense for a Christian to say child molestation is wicked. It's abominable in the eyes of God. I would argue that it should be punished with death. It's so terrible. But I can make sense of that. What you want to know is how can the unbeliever make sense of that? See what I'm getting at? You want to say, well, on what basis do you call that wicked? Now, if the unbeliever gives us his philosophy of ethics or his basis, something that allows for arbitrariness, relativism, then, of course, he's lost the argument. Okay. Now, do we understand this, class? I'm looking. Okay, good. So the person who calls in tells me that good is what gives displeasure or unhappiness. I suggest to the caller that if the Christian God doesn't exist
And good is just what gives pleasure or happiness. And this is a very unhappy thing. He's forgotten that it gave a great deal of happiness, allegedly, to the molester. And so the irony is, and the caller had to stop and think for a while. I think he saw it, but you could tell, you know, it's like, I said, the irony is, your being angry at God for this case of molestation actually condones this case of molestation. Because what you're left with if you reject God is everybody does what's right in his own eyes. And if you have that philosophy, let me just remind you, people who say everyone has the right to do what they want to do don't ever really mean that. They just mean, as long as everybody lives within the general parameters of what I want them to do, everybody has the right to do what they want to do. And so you have to give the counterexample and make them bite the bullet. You say, well, how about the molester? Does he have the right to do what he wants to do? Because if he does, you shouldn't have been trying him and condemning him. You should have just said, well, hey, it's different strokes for different folks. Some people molest children to get their thrills. Okay, now the unbeliever's really unhappy. He says, I don't believe that. And I say, I'm glad you don't believe that, neither do I. But I'd like you to give me an account of your moral condemnation. So earlier when I said you want the unbeliever to take evil seriously, that's because you don't want them to kind of weasel out later with, you know, evil is just what makes people unhappy. Evil is just a relative judgment dependent upon your desires or your ultimate goals. When a person condemns child molestation, or you can pick whatever example you want, they are assuming moral absolutes. But moral absolutes cannot be made sense of, are not intelligible except in the Christian worldview. So up on the board here, when we look at the four things we're considering, remember the preconditions of intelligibility. The problem of evil is not even intelligible. You can't even make sense of the problem of evil unless you begin with the Christian conception of the world. Now, the reply that we'll sometimes get to this is, well, maybe as an unbeliever, I'm not able to call something evil, but the fact is that you Christians, within the circle of your thinking, still have a paradox that has not been resolved. Okay? The unbeliever says, I don't have the right to call that evil, but you call that evil, and I want to know how you can call that evil and still believe that God is all-powerful and God is all good. And kind of, you know, brighten your eyes here, nod your heads. You understand how this is a slightly different approach to the problem? Now we need to answer, how can we believe that there's no inconsistency there? And this is where presuppositional thinking, I think, is so powerful. Remember that we always evaluate our experiences or the particulars that we encounter in light of our ultimate assumptions, our presuppositions. Okay, so what are my ultimate presuppositions? If I'm a Christian, I presuppose God's revelation of himself, what he says about himself in scriptures. And we learn in the scriptures that God is all good, God is all powerful. We also learn in the scriptures that evil exists, but for the time being, I'll just say that's something we observe in the world. If my ultimate presupposition is the goodness and the power of God, and then someone points to evil in the world, I'm going to evaluate that in light of my presuppositions and draw what conclusion? I'm going to draw the conclusion there's a morally sufficient reason for that evil that we find in the world. Okay? If that is my worldview, it is perfectly logical for me to draw the conclusion, not that God doesn't exist, but that God must have a good reason for what he's done. This is a lot more profound logically than you might realize. The unbeliever has brought the problem of evil to you, thinking that you must evaluate evil in a neutral fashion. And if you approach it neutrally, the question is legitimately asked, so is there or is there not such a God? But if my commitment is to the existence of this God, when evil is presented to me, I draw this conclusion, that evil must have a morally sufficient reason, because the God I worship is all-powerful and all-good.
That is just as legitimate a way of reasoning as, actually it's more legitimate, but it's just formally as legitimate as the line of reasoning the unbeliever wants to take, and that is that evil shows God can't be all good or all powerful. And so what you tell the unbeliever is, well, we Christians believe something else. Not only is God all good, not only is God all powerful, we have a third proposition taught to us in the Bible. God is a good reason for everything he does. And with that, there is no longer a logical problem of evil. The logical problem just dissolved. That is, I took the logical sting out of it by adding this other proposition. But I'll bet as you're sitting there, the dissatisfaction, if there is any, with approaching the problem of evil in this way, you feel is, well, yeah, there's no logical problem, but there's certainly a great psychological problem. You see, the problem of evil, ultimately, I don't think is a logical difficulty for people. It isn't all that difficult to point out, well, if God has a good reason for the evil, then it's not, you know, something contrary to his character. If God has a morally sufficient reason for the evil that exists, as the Bible teaches us, his goodness and power are not challenged by the reality of evil events or evil things in human experience. The only logical problem which arises in connection with discussions of evil is the unbeliever's philosophical inability to account for the objectivity of his moral judgments. Okay, so the problem of evil is not fundamentally a logical one. The problem which men have with God when they come face to face with evil and suffering in the world, I want to maintain, is not philosophical, but it's psychological. That is to say, we all find it emotionally very hard to have faith in God and trust his goodness and power when we are not given the reason why bad things happen to us and others. See, the unbeliever presents the problem of evil, I'm suggesting, whether he says it explicitly or not, with this underlying demand. If there's a morally sufficient reason for this evil, then I need to know what it is. Why did such terrible things happen? Unbelievers internally cry out for an answer to that question. By the way, believers do too, as I've already confessed. But God does not always, and indeed if I read the Bible correctly, he rarely provides an explanation to human beings for the evil that they experience or that they observe. In Deuteronomy 29:29, we read, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God." As an aside, I might add, even if God told us why evil things took place, we might not understand it. There's kind of an arrogance in Dr. Bonson or you or the unbeliever when we say, God, give me a reason for why I'm suffering. Because if God were to state to us the reason, we might be totally baffled. And that's because, as Isaiah tells us, God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts. God may be doing things with the evil you're undergoing or that your loved ones undergo, doing things which are so complex and so, in a sense, mysterious, that even if he told you, you might not understand it. But anyway, God doesn't usually tell us why we suffer evil. Nevertheless, the fact remains that though he hasn't given us the reason for our misery and suffering or the injustice of this world, they are part of his plan for history and for our individual lives. And as God says, for those who love him, everything will work together for good, and those who don't love him are going to be ultimately cursed, eternally cursed. So the Bible, you see, calls on us to trust that God has a morally sufficient reason for the evil that is found in this world. But the Bible does not give us the reason or reasons that are morally sufficient for the evil, leaving it up to us then to finally judge whether God has been good or not. But the unbeliever will find that intolerable. Intolerable for his pride, for his feelings, maybe for his rationality. Because he refuses to trust God. He won't believe in a God that doesn't tell him why evil things take place. The unbeliever says, unless I'm given the reason that I can examine and assess, I won't believe in him. And so let's, you know, put it briefly. Look at the whole story, reduce it now. The bottom line is the unbeliever won't trust God unless God subordinates himself to the intellectual authority and the moral evaluation of the unbeliever. That's what it comes down to. The unbeliever says, let God be on trial, and when I'm satisfied that he has a good enough reason for the evil, then I'll trust in him. Unless God consents to trade places with the sinner won't trust him. Now, what do you think? Is God willing to enter into that kind of negotiation? God says, well, since you're the guilty party, I'll have you judge me. No. The problem of evil comes down to the question of whether a person should have faith in God and his word rather than place faith in one's own thinking and evaluations and values. It finally is a question of ultimate authority within a person's life. Now listen, if at the beginning of this lecture, when I introduced the problem of evil, I would have said, you know, that really comes down to just the question of what's your ultimate authority, you all would have said, boy, that sounds a little too quick. But I hope upon analysis you see there's no escape from that. In the end, it's a matter of whether the unbeliever will judge God or whether God will judge the unbeliever. Now, what happens if we say, unbelievers, you all have the right to judge the Almighty? Do unbelievers all agree with one another about what's good and what's evil? Nope. The minute you take it out of the absolute authority of God, in a sense, you've made it impossible for any moral judgment to be made. The only logical approach, and the only one that maintains logical consistency, is to say only God has the right to declare what is good and evil. But from the psychological standpoint, it finally becomes a matter of ultimate commitment and trust. The way in which unbelievers struggle with the problem of evil is only a continuing testimony to the way in which evil entered history in the first place. The Bible tells us that sin and all of its accompanying miseries entered this world through the first transgression of Adam and Eve. And the question with which Adam and Eve were confronted way back then is precisely the question that unbelievers are facing today. Should we have faith in God's word simply because he says so? He says, I've got a morally sufficient reason for what I'm doing. Trust me. Follow this. Or should we evaluate God and his word on the basis of our own ultimate intellectual authority and moral authority? God told Adam and Eve, don't eat of a certain tree, testing them to see if they would define good and evil for themselves. God said, trust me. I'm telling you it's evil. Don't do it. Satan comes along and he challenges the goodness of God. He says, God's got base motives for this, Eve. And so you're going to have to decide, will you really die if you eat of this tree? Can you trust God to do what is right for you, Eve? And the entire course of human history rested on how she would approach that problem. Hypothetically, Eve could have said, I'm not going to listen to you, Satan. Get behind me. You're challenging the word of the only ultimate authority in this world. You have no right to call into question the motives of God or his goodness. But you know that isn't what she did. And instead she said, well, Satan's got a hypothesis. God has a hypothesis. And I'll have to be the final judge. And that's where evil came from on the Christian story. And since they would not presuppose the goodness of God, Adam and Eve have visited upon the human race, whom they, particularly Adam, represented, all the torments that are too many and too painful for us to inventory. When unbelievers refuse to accept the goodness of God on the basis of his own self-revelation, they are simply perpetuating the source of all of our human woes. That is to say, rather than solving the problem of evil, the unbeliever is just part of the problem of evil. And so let's get two things from this lecture. First of all, the problem of evil does not present anything like an intellectual basis for a lack of faith in God. There is no intellectual, or if you will, logical problem in what's called the problem of evil. Rather, what's called the problem of evil is simply a personal expression of a lack of faith. That's true for the unbeliever. When the unbeliever says, I'm not going to trust God, you give me a reason or else. But of course, when it's a psychological problem for Dr. Bonson or for you or any other believer, it's also a lack of faith, isn't it? And when God constantly humbles me and brings me back around that circle again, and he says, will you trust me for the sake of my promises and my word, or do I have to prove everything to you? Or to put it very simply, Greg, will you be God or will I be God? The problem of evil, when it's urged against Christianity, is not a logical problem, it's a psychological problem. It is not a ground for a lack of faith, it is simply an expression of a lack of faith. So the question on the card was, saying that God is all-powerful and all-knowing, why does evil exist? As far as I can see, the only answer the Bible gives us is to glorify God all the more fully. Somebody says, well, how's that going to work? We're going to have to wait to find out. But if you don't wish to glorify him and trust him, you'll find out you won't be able to call anything evil at all. So, from the preconditions of intelligibility, we have now refuted the problem of evil. Another card picks up a little bit on what's sometimes called the problem of evil. It says, how can a loving, sovereign, predestinating God endlessly punish an unbeliever in hell? And many non-Christians use it. They'll say, well, the doctrine of hell is unjust. Well, now, if you saw how I dealt with the problem of evil, you can, by analogy, deal with this too. To say that God is unjust to send somebody to hell forever presupposes some standard of what? Justice. But how can the unbeliever have any standard of justice at all? You see, I told you about the problem of evil. If we believe God is all good and all powerful, and then somebody says evil exists, then we draw the conclusion, well, there must be a morally good reason for it. Likewise, if God is just and he will send sinners to hell forever, then we draw the conclusion, sin must be really bad. The real problem over the doctrine of hell is not what all of these compromising evangelicals want to make it in our day, and it's not the problem that unbelievers claim that it is. The problem of hell is that we don't take sin seriously enough. Because if I believe that God is good and just, and that committing adultery or telling a lie or gossip or whatever is sufficient to send me to hell forever, then that should tell me something about the depth of the wickedness of sin. Because of the infinite holiness of God, sin calls for infinite punishment. How can God endorse genocide in the Old Testament, killing not only men and women, who admittedly were in utter rebellion, but also all the children of the sinful nation? This question, once again, says, how can God be deemed just if he did something like that? What's presupposed by the question? An absolute standard of justice by which God will now stand in judgment. That is, he will be judged by that absolute standard. Well, then how could there be an absolute standard if God himself is not the one who stands behind it? All of these versions of the problem of evil have the same resolution. Ask about the preconditions of intelligibility. By the way, the question here says, admittedly, they were in utter rebellion. Well, if they were in utter rebellion, then God was just for condemning them. Well, then what about their children as well? Well, that brings up another question. Are children guilty before God? Or, let me put it in this form. Does the unbelieving Aborigine Bushman in the heart of Australia in the year 50 AD burn forever when he has never been exposed to the gospel of Jesus Christ? The answer is yes, he does. I don't say that with relish or with glee, but you must take very seriously that the person who has not been exposed to the gospel, even as the child in the previous question, are deemed guilty before God. If you have doubt about that, take the book of Romans, read chapter 1 thoroughly.
Paul tells us that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Paul describes the entire human race as guilty of breaking the laws of God, and that all men know the laws of God through the testimony of conscience and also from the created order round about, and that because all men know these laws, they are guilty for violating them. Please understand, time is short. God is not going to send anybody to hell for not hearing the gospel. When the question is presented this way, the suggestion is, well, if they didn't have a chance, God's being arbitrary. But they are not going to be judged for not hearing the gospel or believing it. They're going to be sent to hell for violating the law of God, which they know in the natural order and in their heart of hearts.